Okay, thank you everyone for coming. Just to quickly introduce myself and fellow speakers. So I'm Anton Kapel. I'm chairing the Cross Practice Actuarial Advice Framework Working Group. So we report to another working group whose name I can't remember, that's then feeding into the Life, Health and General Insurance Practice Committees. So all set up to support the work around CPS 320. Obviously, our working group is focusing on the actuarial advice framework, and we have, I guess, two key deliverables, one being some education around the process, and we had a similar session at the Financial Services Forum last week, and obviously today, and potentially some other sessions in the future. But the in terms of, sort of written output, the main thing we're working towards is an information note to help members who are either drafting, providing advice on, or subsequently reviewing the effectiveness of actuarial advice frameworks. Other speakers have got Tim Clark, Stuart Roger, Susan Louie, and Wayne Brazel, who are all on the working group, and missing today, Bruce Vincent and Daniel Longdon. And Jamie Sash from ANZ as well. So if we kick off, just background, obviously APRA released a sort of fairly advanced draft late last year, and at this stage we're expecting the final versions to come out before 30 June, and the last I heard that was still APRA's timeline. We haven't had any sort of updates on what APRA's thinking in terms of implementation timetable sort of after the final note comes out, but you know, we should expect to at least know what the standard looks like before half year. I've already given you some details on the working group. We've been meeting pretty much weekly now for sort of three and a half months. So to help ourselves sort of get our heads around what was required, we started by just drafting a straw man actuarial advice framework, because it was sort of found it difficult to start drafting advice on or drafting an information note when we didn't know what we were you know, potentially talking about. So we've shared that. I think everyone would have got an email that had a link to that paper. Just quickly, show of hands, has anyone actually been able to go through that straw man framework? I guess two comments. One, I wouldn't claim that as it's written at the moment that it's so it's certainly not best practice. It may not even qualify as a good actuarial advice framework. It's really you know, a straw man. We sort of tossed around whether we should call it a draft, a sample, illustrative. We settled on straw man because it is something that we would like people to sort of tear apart and critique and through that process hopefully help us draft a better information note for members. Finally, just in terms of the purpose of the information note, as I said before, three main audiences for the information note. So we're expecting that in most companies, it'll be the actuary, probably the appointed actuary, who takes the lead in drafting the actuarial advice framework. You know, it will be board approved, but we're expecting most organisations it's an actuary drafting that framework. Expecting that the requirement for the appointed actuary to give advice on the framework before it's first adopted by the board will stay in the final standard. And we're also expecting that there will continue to be a need for the appointed actuary to comment on the effectiveness of the framework annually through the FCR. So that's sort of what we're aiming to get out of the information note is guidance on those three areas. In terms of just the structure of our strawman and obviously the information note largely follows this structure. You know, this is to a large extent sort of mandated by the requirements of CPS 320. So discussion of roles and responsibilities. So primarily that's that covers both the role of business decision makers in an organisation who seek actuarial advice, as well as the actuaries who provide the advice. Areas where advice may be required. So the drafts that APRA distributed late last year had quite extensive appendices that were separate for life, general and health. In our information note, we're trying to avoid having practice-specific guidance, but more discussing topics generically, and I guess hopefully encouraging people to think a little bit beyond the mandated list that will be in the final prudential standard. Then there's a need for a materiality policy. We discuss how the advice that's sought actually gets provided, and there's a requirement to consider conflicts of interest. And then finally, while it's not part of the AAF itself, obviously the information note will address some comments around how you assess the effectiveness of an AAF to help actuaries doing that role. So with those introductory words, I'm going to hand over to Susan now to take us through the first section, being roles and responsibilities. Happy to take questions as we go, so if anyone does want to butt in or disagree with anything we're saying, please do. Certainly when we were sort of going through the process of, you know, drafting our straw man and starting to draft the information note, there were some areas where there was at times quite heated disagreement amongst the working group. Obviously, at the end of the day, we'll land on a position, but there's certainly room for differing views about some of the topics that we're discussing. So, you know, we'd be more than happy to hear from people who disagree with anything that they see or you know, think that we've missed something. And you know, if we've missed something, and we should be adding or discussing an extra topic.
Okay. Can I just clarify? Because one thing I thought about when I read it was.
Hello, Gay Robinson from Affinity. One of my first thoughts when I looked at this was, I don't believe there's any expectation that this will be something we would use as our base. I mean, it's meant as an example.
No, it's meant as a straw man to help this sort of discussion around how we should formulate an information note to guide members.
Okay, but we're not expecting that the Institute will tell us this is what your AAF has to look like.
No, definitely.
Good.
Not.
I just wanted to clarify that. I think that's important in the context. Yep. Thank you.
I think it would be play out like the ICAP played out, where you set the structures up. I think it would play out like...
Not on. Just sorry, if people are asking questions, please do wait for a mic, because we've got people on the webinar who won't be able to hear without the mic.
Sorry about that. I think it'll play out very much like the ICAP played out when APRA first introduced it, and there's kind of a... we all implement one way, and then APRA sees the aggregation of them all and comes around and nudges you towards best practice or what they think is best practice, picking up bits and pieces of everyone's. And I reckon the AAF is going to go the same way.
Okay. Sorry, Damien.
Thanks, Anton. It's Damien Thornley, consulting actuary. Just a question around the straw man and the feedback that you're requesting. Is there a process that you'd like us to follow if we do want to send comments to the working group? Do we just email them to yourself?
Yes, you can email any one of us, or if it's something worth discussing, please raise
okay.
it.
Okay, thanks. Just wanted to clarify.
Hi everyone, my name is Susan Louis, and I'm here to talk about the roles and responsibilities of those parties that are in the framework. As further to Gay's point, I mean, just to emphasise this, in the course of the working group discussions, I think there was wide recognition that, you know, we may have a lot of different models, and actually company structures and companies themselves, depending on the types of business they're in, of different complexities. And indeed different management and governance frameworks. So we're very aware of that, and so there will be, I think, as an outcome of this requirement of APRA's, a whole bunch of different actuarial advice frameworks out there. Okay. When we constructed the straw man, just to let you know, we probably focus more on a more complex structure that we could think about, which is probably a large life-like company, but of course many other models could exist. So with roles and responsibilities, with roles and responsibilities in the framework, well, there's really two parties, actuaries and the business stakeholders or decision makers who might receive actuarial advice. The decision makers, of course, are comprised of your board and your management team. And there is some mention of that in the straw man that also will be in our information note. One of the things that we would not mind seeking further input into is really to what extent are the roles of the recipients of the advice, the decision makers, to what extent do they go to considering what should be documented, for instance, or recorded, if actuarial advice on significant matters is followed or indeed not followed. Okay, so it's just a thought that I just want to park with you, but I would be interested in hearing views on that. To the roles of the actuaries, I mean, we've classified them into two categories, the appointed actuary and all other actuaries. Okay, so for want of a better term, we call them the advising actuary, and that could be an actuary providing advice to management or the board, or indeed the appointed actuary as well in some cases. The actuarial advice framework, we believe, should define responsibility for the provision of the advice, but could also allow the AA or the other advising actuaries to delegate or rely on the work of another actuary. And when we talk about actuaries or advising actuaries, they could, of course, be internal as well as external or consulting actuaries. When in the considerations of, you know, for delegation or reliance on the work of someone else, judgment should be used, of course, depending on the situation. Some of the factors that we believe and which we will outline in the information note could look like this. Number one, complexity and materiality of the matter under consideration. Two, the capability or experience of the actuary to which you're delegating or relying on. Three, the validation or the peer review process that may be undertaken by the actuary or, you know, consulting actuaries. Four, the entity or the group or indeed regulatory requirements. Board requirements and delegated authorities, and five, of course, potential conflicts of interest in terms of who you delegate to. There's one thing that I do want to emphasise in terms of roles and responsibilities is that, in particular for the appointed actuary, of course, prescribed responsibilities may not be delegated. So you can't, unfortunately, leave it to your junior actuary to do your FCR. I mean, you've got to do that if you're an appointed actuary. That's about it in terms of roles and responsibilities. I'm now going to hand over to, who's next?
Stuart.
Yeah. Yep. Up you come, Stuart.
Thanks, Stuart Roger from Deloitte. And I'm going to talk about the areas where advice may be required and what you need to think through as you weave that into the actuarial advice framework. So firstly, after a fair bit of discussion, we drew out some principles that we think needs to apply to this. So this is like, which areas are you going to need advice in the company? And the first one that we came up with was that it would be a real disappointment if every insurer ends up with the same list, right? It would be a real disappointment if insurers view this as a compliance exercise and the framework consigns actuaries to the bare minimum. The framework is actually a framework for the company to receive actuarial advice when it needs it. And if you think about a company's needs, they don't just boil down to keeping APRA happy. A company's needs are even more fundamental, keeping their customers happy, keeping their owners happy, staying in business, competing effectively, right? And if you view it in that light, then the profession is being invited to become part of each individual's company's competitive advantage and the way that each company will help to build that into its framework is by getting an actuarial advice framework which homes in on the areas where it wants to compete. The stakeholders, be they policyholders or shareholders or community, where it seeks to make a positive impact, and then to translate that into a doable job as opposed to the somewhat undoable job that was starting to emerge, perhaps for the life insurance actuaries in particular. So our first principle was each company should make its own decisions about the areas that its advice framework will deal with. Second principle, the areas listed by APRA in CPS, they're just a minimum. And a few things flow from that. Don't start with it, because if you start with a minimum, you've got the rails set, right? And really difficult to think outside. More start with, as an actuary, how am I going to give my company a competitive advantage over the others? As an actuary, how am I going to help my company satisfy its stakeholders more than the others? We also felt important to look cross-industry. We've got a life sector with decades and decades of appointed actuary tradition. We've got a general insurance sector with a decade of formal appointed actuary stuff, more than a decade now, and a health insurance sector. And each of those three have kind of grown up with different practitioners laying out what was required. We feel that it's very much time now in this framework to look across industry and draw out the principles that our colleagues across the wall in another part of the insurance sector have found effective in helping an insurer work with actuarial advice. Look for the best of breed. And I've mentioned the need to be constantly thinking about the insurer's stakeholders in identifying these areas. And then the other bit, we're going to list somehow in our frameworks the areas where people need to get actuarial advice. The primary audience for that isn't the actuaries. They already know, or maybe need reinforcement. The primary audience is the other people, all the different roles that Susan talked about, many of whom are not actuaries. And we found ourselves, even in the working group, constantly slipping back into actuarial paradigms and actuarial phraseology and actuarial kind of say a phrase and a whole stack of stuff suddenly we all understood. That's not going to happen with some of the key audiences for this document. So the communication will be a real art. Is it principles that we felt underlay the choice of what we say about where the advice is required? Now, can I just have a show of hands? Are we talking to anyone here who's actually sat down and done a first go themselves at an advice framework? Is there anyone in that position? Yeah, we've got one. And okay, we've got one. Good. Whose hand went like this, not like this. Yeah, cool. Okay. So let me just pass you a microphone, Warwick.
Warwick Guard, EY. I was just saying, in a sense, because the health insurance requirements around notifiable circumstances has been exercised in a way, when I've been doing it, as building with the company and the board, the list of occasions and circumstances whereby which they should be engaging me for advice. And so I don't see it as hugely different to this requirement in the way that I operationalised the notifiable circumstances requirement. So I don't think it's that different.
So part of me agrees with what you just said. My background is private health insurance in this as well. And part of me disagrees. I think it is a mistake to start by assuming that what we currently do optimises this new regime. You didn't quite say that. On the other hand, when the health insurance regulator sat down with Health Practice Committee after the Health Insurance Act was in the process of passing it, and said they didn't say We have these prudential requirements. How can we make sure they're met? They actually said, how can we ensure that the board will get actuarial advice when it needs it, right? Which is the actual broad question. And at some stage, one of the partners from PwC a few years later looked at that and said, my God, this is such a wide mandate for health that you've got everything here, right? It came from how do you ensure a board will get actuarial advice when it needs it, not just the prudential stuff. But on the other hand, so we've in health insurance, we've done that approach, but I still think it's a mistake to assume, no matter where we're starting from, that what we've been doing for the last 10 years is a way to go. And the question I asked was, has anyone started to think about this? Many companies actually have some form of policy in place for their actuarial advice or their appointed actuaries' policies or whatever. And so, in a way, yes, we all have thought about this. It's a chance, though, to think afresh with a new mandate and put in that mandate the stuff where our profession will be really useful to the companies. So
David Rush.
Nice to be noticed, Stuart. following on from that point, I'm David Rush, by the way. Following on from that point, and it goes to your principle number two, I'd agree that the list that APRA puts in CPS 320 is only a minimum. You want to consider more than that. So I agree, don't start there. But a word of warning, if you're going to say, oh, we need to give advice on this thing which is not on the list, and then we also need to give advice on this other thing which is not on the list, and we need to give advice on this thing which is not on the list, sooner or later you're going to end up with exactly the same problem that actuaries had when this whole thing first started, that the list is far too long, they have to give advice on pretty much everything, and they can't do it.
That's a important point, and one that, using the next slide, I will also want to make. And another one of the reasons why we think that companies have genuine decisions to make here, and that's why the top point, each insurer should make those decisions itself and hence end up with a different advice framework. And decisions involve, by definition, choosing between options and excluding some options. And so an insurer who just puts everything into the pie and says, we'll do everything, is going to have exactly the problem you face, right? So this is the slide about the principles of where a company needs advice. In the next one, we'll go into a bit more detail. But just before I do, our way into this was to start thinking a bit of a brainstorm about where should a company get advice, where are the out there kind of ideas that actually make a bit of sense when you think about them. The traditional ones are pretty clear. And maybe just for 20 seconds, if I can have a participative audience, throw a few things at me, and I'll say them into the mic for people on the webinar, about what areas should be covered in the advice. I'm taking the clear traditional valuation liability type stuff as already spoken. What else? Yeah, Warwick, yeah, call it out.
There might be product development.
Product development?
Pricing.
Mergers and acquisitions.
Risk management.
Diversification.
Business planning.
Okay. So we start to get into things that are whole of company, not just actuarial kind of risk kind of calculation type stuff, don't we? So I'm going to swap the slide. We ended up that we had a couple of goes at this brainstorm. We ended up with 70 or 80 things that a company might do and it might need actuarial advice on. When you look back at them, there's perhaps 15 different identifiable categories that they fall into. Here, there's, I think that's 15 on this slide here. Some of them are pretty obvious, the liability evaluation, prudential capital. The third bullet point, it just says financial reporting and budgeting, but the whole of IFRS 17, et cetera, fits into that, your whole monthly reporting cycle and your entire relationship with the finance division of the insurer fits into that. So a few words, but quite big. And then the out there ones, M&A, at what point does the actuarial advice need to come into that process? And different companies will take different approaches to that. The third last bullet point, this comes out of the health insurance world where any list we came up with was going to not cover the things we hadn't thought of. And so we put a duty on the appointed actuary to be watching out there on anything else that was going to affect the financial condition of the insurer. And if that, in the appointed actuary's opinion, mattered, draw it to their attention. Now, there's sort of analogies to that in the ongoing continuous nature of the appointed actuary role in other insurer sectors. You've got an implied duty to bring to the attention of the company stuff you know about, which wasn't explicitly covered, and it's implied by the continuous nature of that role as opposed to a project by project role. But so we have that as an explicit category there. And here's where we need to make the point that David made very ably, right? There is everything on this list, right? So how do you turn it into a manageable job, an achievable job? And get a sensible workload and a sensible allocation of resources out of it. So I think we see that you don't just view this section in isolation. You view this in conjunction with what Susan said about the roles. And if there's not a role for something because the company doesn't need it, then for heaven's sake, it doesn't need the advice on that, that would naturally come from that role. There's also seniority built into roles and what kind of issues come to the attention of that person, and that will by its nature exclude issues. But then there's also, and APRA requires this, a materiality policy, and Wayne's going to talk about that. So the interaction with roles, delegations, materiality, and the company's own purpose and vision will help to prioritise which of these areas are critical to get actuarial advice and which of them maybe a lesser degree of actuarial advice or maybe advice in arrears, you know, kind of a learn from experience kind of approach or something even weaker than that. So I'm going to pass to Wayne to talk about the... Warwick, there's a question from Warwick Gard and there's a microphone coming. Right behind you, Warwick.
Yeah. Surely the criteria shouldn't be whether it's manageable. Surely the criteria should be whether it's adding value to the business. I'd hate to be thinking we're structuring the advice framework based on a view whether it's manageable or not. That's totally arse up, I would
say. So if I said that should be the only criterion, then I was wrong, right? I don't think I actually said that. I think that I was agreeing with David that it's one of the criteria. And where I'm coming from there is every business I have ever been in throughout my entire career has more valuable ideas than it has resources to put into. And it's always had to prioritise them. You see it most clearly in all the different things you can do with your IT system where there's always a filter bed and always a prioritisation process and always some section of the company or management who's a little bit cross because in there it was optimum for their area but it wasn't optimum for the company. And I think it's that kind of manageable workload that we're talking about that no company can afford to do every possible piece of actuarial work that would add value. And what it has to do is prioritise the actuarial value adds down to a certain level And then maybe below that level, the next piece of IT work adds more value. And that's what company decision-making is about. So that's what I meant when I said bring manageable workload into it.
Oh,
yeah, another question. Warwick doesn't agree, but I do.
It's Martin Lamb from Hanover Life Re. Have we approached this in terms of how defining actual advice and what that entails? Is that about financial soundness, asset liabilities, and so on, uncertainty about future events and things like that, to sort of scope the actual advice?
We didn't get draw the line-y on this is actuarial advice, this is not. We more felt that if you put it into your actuarial advice framework as something that needs to happen, then it's kind of actuarial advice because your company's decided it should be in the framework. I think we're also a bit relaxed about who actually does the work for it and do they have a fellowship of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia as their qualification. There may be, in almost all circumstances, there needs to be someone with that qualification accountable and taking responsibility for the advice, but a lot of the actual work may be delivered by it. We're coming to that. It's time to hand over.
Yeah. Thanks, Stuart. It's great that there is so much discussion, because a lot of what's gone on already is talking to the materiality policy or how to judge materiality of the AA advice framework. I think, there's very much a common theme coming out. Gail's comments about, it shouldn't be one size fits all. Stuart's very clearly articulated that it needs to be specific to the company. I'd reiterate that. It's very much about our function as actuaries is to optimise the risk taking for the company. It's not about pure downside risk protection. It's about upside optimization as well. And so when we think about that, that in my mind is the right sort of starting point to determine what the materiality level should be. And likewise, to David's point, that you can't have this such that everything has to be going to the appointed actuary for their sign off, because that has been the problem that we've had, which is meant that in many cases the appointed actuary hasn't been in the bigger strategic discussions that actually are more important for the optimization of risk for the company as a whole, rather than just piece by piece decisions that in many cases are immediate but in the long run won't protect the company. In some ways I see the AA advice framework almost like a financial condition report, but in advance. The FCR is very much backward looking, saying, well, this is what's happened, and taking from that and extrapolating forward. To me, the AA advice, or sorry, the Actuarial Advice Framework, should be a lot more about that forward looking perspective. I think when we consider the materiality policy, or sorry, how we determine materiality and therefore delegations, we need to be thinking about, as we said, the company. So it's about what capacity the company has to take risk, what's its appetite for risk, and what is the capability of the systems and the processes within the company. When you take that into account, I think it then leads nicely into, well, what level of judgment needs to be overlaid on top of all of that to then ensure that the risk-taking is within the company's appetite. And that will then determine whether or not you need the different levels of actuary, because we're certainly seeing this as an opportunity to free up the more senior actuaries to get into the strategic discussions rather than be bogged down in signing off on system criteria potentially for data capture, or signing off on a quotation system, etc. We really want to make sure that not only is it optimising
the company risk taking, but optimizing the value that the actuarial function can provide by making sure the advice is specific to the needs. But other, I guess, considerations in the materiality will need to be who's receiving the advice. It's a little difficult. You need to be considering the influence that the actuary can bring in the context. So if it's going to the board, you wouldn't want a student providing the advice. You've got to make sure that the advice is at a sufficiently senior level to ensure that the right influence is brought to the table. We've got a number of examples here. So who's asking? When should they ask? I think potentially there is materiality comes down to timing as well. If it's early in the process and there's a potential for shaping the outcome, I think it can be a more junior person. But as a lot of you would have experienced, some of these decisions come to the actuary when a lot of things are locked in. And, you know, if there's something that you would disagree with, you need a pretty strong case to be able to actually unwind some of the decisions. So I think timing would be part of that question as well. It also is a case of what are the risks that we're talking about and what are the diversification across the company. So, you know, for some companies where their diversification is low on one risk, that's probably an area where you need a more senior level of advice, whereas if you think in terms of your capacity across the different types of risks, if you're very low on the scale in one area, then that's something that can probably be accepted quite well at a lower level, at a higher level of materiality. I certainly like what's the health insurance concept of notifiable circumstances. I think this in many ways is trying to look at that, but again, in the same way, there needs to be understanding of the people actually requiring the advice, when and to whom. So it's got to be, when we look at assessing the materiality, we've got to be thinking about, as I say, the influence that can be brought to the table, the ability of the general executives in the company and management to understand the framework and who to go to. It needs to link in effectively with all the other policies. I'm sure a lot of companies have policies on pricing, policies in terms of you've got your risk appetite statement, you've got your reinsurance strategy. So it needs to be consistent with those as well. We also need to be able to just assess in assessing the materiality, we've obviously got to monitor its effectiveness. So that comes down to, how are we going to document the decisions being made? Is there a way of actually feeding that back into a control cycle concept of being able to assess the effectiveness of that? I think there's also an aspect of what other professionals need to be involved, because I think the benefit that we bring in our judgment is not just bringing the actuarial expertise itself, but to be able to synthesize the advice of other professionals as well. Anyone signing off on pricing will need to bring in the underwriting considerations and the advice there, the claims management and so forth. And so I think that's another aspect of the framework and assessing the materiality and its effectiveness. So the provision of advice, as I say, timing is important. How do you actually set up the process for determining who provides it? obviously a lot can be documented, but a lot of this comes down to judgment. So, you know, one of the questions would be, do you have a gatekeeper, perhaps a senior actuary, who's able to quickly assess what the requirements are to make sure that it's all the potential issues are understood before the actual advice is provided. Does it need to follow a consistent structure? This is not across companies, but this we're thinking in terms of internally to the company to enable a much better assessment as to whether or not the advice is actually meeting the standard. It needs to be, the third point here, it can't be constrained by the framework. It's important that the judgment is allowed, and perhaps ensuring that it's very clear to the audience what is judgment versus what is purely the facts coming through and just an aggregation or assimilation of those facts. We also talked a lot about oral versus written. And this was actually quite, we had a number of discussions around this. It is quite a contentious one from the point of view of, we want to ensure that our function is fit for purpose for the company. And you don't want to get, again, to David's point, this can't be a compliance exercise. It can't be bogged down in documentation when it's very minor things. So there does need to be a line drawn between what can be oral advice versus written advice. To the extent that we need to be able to track what advice is being given, be able to demonstrate that, there does need to be written advice, whether that's before the decision is being taken or whether it's after, would be something that would need to be considered, I think, in the framework, as well as how you monitor what has been provided on orally. I think that's probably the key things. It's clear that there's a lot of views around this. It links very much into the areas of advice, the purpose, and the nature of the company, which has already been discussed to some extent, but very happy to field questions. Okay, I'll hand over to Tim.
No.
Sorry?
No, apparently I'm having a second shot up here. I've got to talk about conflicts of interest. Cool. Thank you. Thanks, Wayne. Conflicts of interest. This should not be a new area for many of us out there who've performed or are performing appointed actuary roles or some sort of possibly board board reporting type role. The draft Prudential Standard 320 requires that there needs to be some consideration of conflicts. What does it mean? We've had many a discussion of this internally, and you know, Anton had mentioned those lovely Monday evenings from 5 to 6:30 when we're going at hammer and tongs talking about what does conflict mean. And I think there was general agreement that, you know, actuarial advice really, any actuarial advice really should be first and foremost impartial, unbiased, impartial, objective. Okay. The actuarial advice framework should recognise that, as well as actual conflicts, it's also the issue of perceived conflicts. You know, even if there is not one there, it may well look that way to the different stakeholders that we might deal with. And you know, there's some examples. These aren't perceived, actually. These are actual conflicts. So some typical examples come to mind. You may have an appointed actuary who's also the chief financial officer of an organisation. So the AIA might provide advice on, you know, reserves, capital. The CFO may want to put a dividend recommendation out, for example, to you know, his management team and the board. You know, if those two roles are performed by the same person, what does that mean in terms of potentially conflicted advice? Another one is to do with reporting lines, and this happens, I think, everywhere, really. You know, you may have a pricing actuary who's providing pricing advice on a significant product development or a new product development, you know, and he or she reports to the head of product. So, you know, there's conflicts, potential conflicts there already that need to be managed just from a reporting lines perspective.
I'm not going to go into with too many examples. There's actually quite a few examples of this, and some of them I think some of us are living through now. Actually, I'll give the situation myself. It's probably the easiest. I mean, without going to any of the details, I come from ANZ Wealth, which owns a suite of businesses in a multiple business lines, multiple distribution channels. It includes the OnePath life and general insurance businesses, as well as lenders mortgage insurance, superannuation, et cetera, et cetera. I sit in a role where I advise multiple boards on things like ICAP and capital and risk appetite. And in situations, and this is common, I think, across the industry, where a life company may be an administrator to, say, you know, your superannuation funds, they are inherently some conflicts. So how do you manage those? So you put all that together and then throw some M&A activity on top, which is, you know, on selling to multiple acquirers at the same time. And there is a mishmash of complexities that need to be taken into account of. I'm not saying that the actuarial advice framework purports to solve all those issues. I mean, that's something that's got to be done in conjunction with, I think, in some cases, depending on the structure of your company secretary or your risk and compliance people or the legal department. But what we recognise is that the conflicts of interest in some cases is very real. And so what do we recommend, I suppose, in the information note for things for actuaries to consider when trying to manage this? The delivery of impartial advice is dependent on, firstly, the identification by the AA or the advising actuary themselves of the conflict, okay, and then therefore managing it as appropriate. From a business user or stakeholder perspective or the recipient of the advice, they also need to consider the disclosures and actually the appropriateness in actually accepting that advice. I mean, I haven't seen anyone really actually refusing to accept actuarial advice because they think it's such a conflict. Typically, you would hope that it's managed well beforehand in terms of some active discourse between the parties. Some of the management mechanisms that we discuss and we've considered, and I'm sure many of you may be familiar with, are the typical ones, which are, one, the disclosure and the nature and indeed the materiality of the potential conflict itself. Two, a clear separation of roles, if there are multiple roles being performed in terms of your provision of advice to management or your board. Three, and this is quite a strong one, it's really review and review of any sort. And it can be a peer review or an internal review by an actuary or other parties. Actually, they may not be actuaries, I suppose, other parties that sit independently of the function that actuaries are in. Or in cases where, especially with material, external advice, so independent external advice that you may ask to be provided, okay, in alongside with the original piece of actuarial advice to the board. In some cases, we think an actuary may choose to decline to provide that advice. I haven't personally seen it myself. I don't know if anybody else in this room has, but please raise your hand up, I mean, if you have, because I'll be very interested to hear such a situation. Really, for significant conflicts, we believe also that the appointed actuarial advice framework may require the recipient to document and acknowledge their consideration of the conflict. You know, when we have boards, when we're dealing with boards, that's quite an easy thing to do because they're typically minuted and you've got, you know, it's quite a set kind of framework, you know, in terms of the corporate governance and company secretarial type duties in terms of minutes of boards and so on. But, you know, elsewhere, when advice is provided outside the context of the formal board, I'm not sure to what extent, you know, like we've, you know, there's a lot of formality around a lot of things. So that's one of the things that we do want people to consider when they are looking at the actuarial advice framework. I think that's about all that we want to say. Is there anything else that I'll miss in conflicts? Because goodness knows we've spent enough time talking about impartial advice. Nope. Okay. I think that's it from me. And over to you, Anton.
Actually, just before we move off conflicts, just a quick question to the audience. Can an actuary give advice on a proposal that the actuary has put forward? that's a yes-no question. So can an actuary give advice on something that they're proposing themselves?
Critique their own advice, is that what you're saying?
Can they give advice on something that they are proposing? So I don't want to use the word critique. Can they give advice on a proposal that they are making? Yes?
Hands up.
No? Yeah, so I mean, we did sort of discuss this. This comes down to the question of impartiality versus independence. So you cannot give independent advice if you are putting the proposal forward. That's a contradiction. I don't think there's any requirement in the drafts of CPS 320 that we've seen to date that require actuarial advice to be independent. It'd be open to a company to decide that its actuarial advice needs to be independent, but I wouldn't personally go there myself. I think it's perfectly reasonable for somebody to give impartial advice on something they're proposing themselves. And by definition, if you think it's a good idea that you're willing to propose it, you should be able to say why you're proposing it, and that is advice. So just, you know, worth just thinking about as you're drafting an advice framework, be very cautious about using the word independent, whether you really need that or not. Final topic, this obviously isn't part of an actuarial advice framework itself, but it will be part of the information note. So assessing the effectiveness of an actuarial advice framework. We've, you know, appointed actuaries have responsibilities currently to assess the effectiveness of the risk management framework. I'm not sure that sort of it's easy to draft guidance on how to carry out such an activity. Where we're heading for the information note is to put together a list of questions that might help people come to an assessment of whether a framework's effective or not. There will be something we believe will be very brief going into a professional standard, and then the intent is that in the information note that we draft, that we'll put together a longer list than what you see on this slide of questions that you know could help. So things like, you know, have decision makers clearly understood when they need to seek advice? Given that, you know, the primary audience of an actuarial advice framework is actually business decision makers rather than actuaries, and you know the primary responsibility will be on those people to seek advice rather than the actuary to give advice. That's a sort of threshold question. That's a really critical question. Was the actuary provided with appropriate information in a timely manner to enable proper advice to be given? You know, were conflicts that existed identified, and were they dealt with properly? And finally, I think that there's an ongoing need to consider whether that sort of list of topics where the AAF requires advice to be given, whether that's an appropriate list. So during the course of a year, has something happened that did not get advice that should have got advice with hindsight because it would have led to a better decision? So I think that's worth sort of bearing in mind at all times.
So are you suggesting, sorry.
Are you suggesting that the actuary responsible for the actuarial framework is assessing the effectiveness of the actuarial advice framework?
Ultimately, the board will own the framework, so it will be a board.
We've already discussed how you think that the appointed actuary will be drafting and preparing it for the board.
My guess is in most companies the appointed actuary will draft it,
and then you're saying that same person's going to assess the effectiveness of it.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I would find that. In my view, I find that a conflict. I can't see how you could do that and say whether you think it's working well or not. I can see you being at providing all those answers into, say, I don't know, internal audit assessing the effectiveness of a framework. But we're going to then ask decision makers if they thought the advice that they got from us was effective, no. And we were going to report on that on our own advice.
Well, it's I mean, obviously we'll have to wait and see what the final standard says, but as worded in the currently draft, it is a question to say, has the framework in totality been effective? So it's not whether good advice was given or not, it's whether the framework has been effective. And yes, and I think that's reasonable for APRA to say that the appointed actuary should comment on that in the FCR.
Yeah, and I think that, okay, so certainly from an actuary would have the actuary would have their perspective on that, and I can see why you would require the actuary to provide comment on that. If I was advising a company around this, I would build a bigger review around that, that I would be making sure there's some independent lens cast over that assessment.
Warwick, it is important to distinguish the framework from the quality of any particular piece of actuarial advice, and my guess is a really good framework would find that in reality the quality of the advice differs across the year based on a whole stack of things, and the framework would be a process by which the stakeholders get to recognise that and get to understand how to continuously improve the quality of that advice as well. That's why I agree that reviewing the effectiveness of the framework is a bigger question than reviewing the effectiveness of any particular piece of advice. I'm not disagreeing
but it's difficult to separate, because the framework is going to say, well, for these issues, you don't need to get the appointed actuary to give advice. You can get someone else to give advice, and for these issues, it'll be this person. Surely then, if the framework's working effectively, the board or the users of the advice will feel that they're getting reasonable advice, or useful advice in each circumstance, and that this advice over here shouldn't be provided by a more senior person or a less senior person. I don't know how...
There's a design versus operating effectiveness element in auditing parlance. You can't test the design by yourself because you designed it. You can test the operating effectiveness by
Maybe what's needed is the ICAP. Every 3 years you need to get an independent review of the framework then.
But there will be some objective measures in terms of, you know, have there been decisions made by at certain levels that later it's discovered that things have been missed. So if you think about a product development process, there'll be objective measures there. There'll be objective measures as to has this unduly slowed down the process for no value in terms of it's had to go through a more rigorous advice process, and it's had to draw in the appointed actuary, and therefore it's taken longer. I think I think there is very much the need to differentiate the framework from the quality of the advice itself. But an element, as you say, has to be the user of the information. Absolutely, but it's definitely like everything in the FCR, it's not fully the appointed actuary's view. The appointed actuary's got to get input from across the business and understand from the various professionals what's going on.
Chow Chow from PwC. I believe one of the motivations of APRA trying to get an AAF is their view of the actuary's role being boxed in a certain way over the years. And so to ensure that the board is able to get the advice that it needs when it gets it, then shouldn't the board take the leadership in assessing whether that's happening and whether the AAF is effective for it to achieve what it wants the actuary to achieve?
Of course the board will do that, as the board assesses every policy that it signs. It doesn't require them to write it. It doesn't require there to be a standard to say that the board must assess the effectiveness of it. I mean, that's the job of the board. So, yes, but it doesn't need to be written down anywhere. They've got those responsibilities.
And you would hope with a good board that's already happening, irrespective of whether there's a framework in place or not. They deal with appointed actuaries' advice, and they would assess themselves now in terms of how good or otherwise that advice would have been. I see Warwick's point. It's back to that conflicts of interest versus maybe perceived conflict of interest here, because if you've got the author of the framework being the appointed actuary and then he or she is also reviewing it in year one, you think, well, what good is that? He's not going to give himself a bad report card, is he, for example. It really, again, it comes back to your board or perhaps your senior management team in terms of how comfortable they are in terms of who assesses the effectiveness of that framework. I think in many cases, especially with a zealous board, and I've dealt with a few of those in my time, they would absolutely insist on a third party like audit, internal audit, or actually an external consulting actuary to come and look at the framework, especially at inception.
I think also in terms of, as the appointed actuary, I'm responsible for all the actuarial advice provided in the company. And so, yes, the advice ultimately is going to be judged by the board and the company. But to the extent that I'm having to pick up pieces because the delegated authorities have been at too high a level and there's been mistakes in the advice, I'm going to have to wear that and I'm going to have to pick up the pieces. So in the same way that I assess the performance of my team and making sure that things are working appropriately and efficiently, of course I'm going to be in a position to assess the effectiveness of the advice coming up through, because ultimately I'm responsible for it and I'm going to have to wear it.
Warwick, we're going to find ourselves as appointed actuaries inevitably commenting on the effectiveness of the framework in our FCRs each year. So we can't step back from the role. Doesn't mean that we'd be the only ones to comment on it.
Okay. I got the mic. Reflecting on what APRA's trying to do here, what I think they've said is there's a small number of things the AA must do, and for everything else that the company has the freedom to decide what happens. Is it AA? Is it someone else? Is it done? Is it not done? Is this a detailed framework? Is it less detailed? So reflecting on the diversity of opinions and views we've had here, actually there's room for all of them. You can talk to your principals and your boards and put your point of view forward, and that may be what ends up in the document, or it may be that it doesn't, because ultimately it's not. We have this review function here, but ultimately it's not our choice. So a lot of these arguments, we can all have our way. We can all put our opinion. The guidance note will be very helpful, but ultimately these are board decisions.
Well, in terms of assessing the effectiveness, that'll be APRA's decision, because at the moment the draft of CPS 320 says the AA must include an assessment of the effectiveness of the actuarial advice framework in the FCR.
So that's one of the
that aspect will be mandated.
That's one of a very small number of things that the AA must do, and I think that's right. So you can give flexibility around everything else, and then this is us having our opportunity to come in and say whether it's working. So this is a very important piece.
David Rush again. Anton, you made a point earlier on about boards, and everybody expect that the board would do those sort of things, and they need to be written down. That's all well and good, and it's ideal, but the problem is that some boards haven't actually been doing that, and that is why the likes of APRA have put out prudential standards to say what boards should do.
Which is why we have a code of conduct.
Any other questions on that one?
Just a couple of things that have come out as well. We do need to think around the nature of advice. We talked about verbal versus oral to Martin's comments, and we do need to reflect on the code of conduct and how this will work out with the code of conduct as well. So I just wanted to make that point. And Wayne, I'm a bit interested in your comment that as the appointed actuary, you think you're responsible for all actuarial advice that happens throughout the firm. I thought part of the actuarial advice framework doesn't even delegate. It just says the board expects to get actuarial advice, not necessarily from the appointed actuary in certain circumstances. And that advice, you know, you might opine on it in the financial condition report if it comes through in that need, but there can be advice that is not yours to own. It's an actuary's to own. So if I was sitting as the appointed actuary, I wouldn't want to take responsibility. I'd want responsibility for advice to have been given, but not responsibility for the advice given, if I can phrase it that way.
Yeah, so I guess my point is I'm responsible to make sure that the person who's providing the advice, I'm comfortable, is at the right level of experience and expertise, and I guess that's my responsibility, that I've taken the right measures to ensure that the standard of the advice will be what I think is acceptable.
Just one more comment on that, just to finish up on that one. So certainly in terms of the information note that we're drafting, there's recognition that all those models could exist. You may have a very large company with multiple actuaries providing advice everywhere. So, you know, I don't know whether an AA can keep on top of the advice of 50 separate actuaries sitting in a variety of different functions versus maybe a small organisation where they may just be the one actuarial department where the appointed actuary really runs his or her eye over everything. So at the moment, we recognise both, and I think the framework that has to come has to be fit for purpose for your organisation in consultation with the management team and the board.
Yeah, thanks. I think they're great points. And then if the note could then deal with, like, in areas that other actuaries are giving advice that are then part of your FCR as the appointed actuary, and you're reviewing the advice of what other actuaries have provided internally, how you then resolve issues where you might not agree with that advice, because that may well occur. What do we do in that circumstance? So, you know, I guess I would not be suggesting, I think it's the wrong answer to say, well, the actuary has to take responsibility for all advice, because that's the whole point of doing this is making sure that doesn't have to happen. But there will, we need to sort of consider the position of, okay, then what happens when you have a fundamental disagreement with the advice of one of the actuaries giving advice in an area that you're going to comment on in your FCR? How does that play out in an organisation, and how do you manage that? Because that can be quite detrimental to the profession as a whole, I'd imagine.
You're raising something in the code of conduct. If you see poor actuarial advice everywhere, you've got professional responsibility to declare it. Hopefully it doesn't come up in my circumstance in my time.
It's a problem, yeah.
But I'm not sure that you would want to get to a position where, as part of the assessment of effectiveness, you need to review all advice that was given. That's not...
No, I'm not thinking about that, but say in the FCR...
They buy the wrong reinsurance.
Part of our responsibility is to talk to the reinsurance arrangements, for instance. Say for your actuarial control advice framework, you've said that advice on reinsurance needs to be given by... chief actuary reinsurance doesn't need to be given by the appointed actuary. The appointed actuary reviews the reinsurance arrangements and such, has a bit of a problem with it in terms of how he thinks it meets the overall requirements of the organisation. That causes him then perhaps to review the actuarial advice provided, and he disagrees with it. So that could be a situation that happens. So again, you know, I guess from our circumstance, how do we go about resolving that? How do we go about making sure that at the end of the day, the company's getting the right advice? Because at the end of the day, this is all going to be judged by how much value the companies are getting out of their actuaries in the future compared to the assessed value in the past.
Yeah, I mean, coming back to Tim's point, I think there's a distinction between somebody in the organisation giving bad advice and somebody giving different advice, or even so there's a similar situation exists at the moment in that the actuary has a responsibility for giving advice, but the company doesn't have to follow that advice. So take reinsurance as an example. It's certainly possible that the reinsurance program that the company adopts is not what the appointed actuary would adopt if the appointed actuary was making the decision. So you can comment on differences and implications of decisions that may not necessarily imply that any advice that was given was poor advice.
Anton, we're kind of going around the question of within the framework, how does the framework make sure that a suitable quality of advice is delivered? That's kind of the general topic, and you picked up a couple of examples of that. The slide that dealt with provision of advice, and we had a point two there that said, should actuarial advice under the framework follow a consistent structure? Would we include metrics for the structure of that advice, or should the advice include standard things that fit with the company's own metrics? Those kind of things are where we were starting to say the framework somehow needs to lead people into a consistent quality of advice. And if you get that consistent, if you get that laid out somehow, then you're in a position then to assess against that required quality as well.
Sorry, just another question here on this framework. Is it ultimately similar to a performance review of the actuarial team or the appointed actuary and so on? And if that's the case, then we need to go back to the decision makers, and there needs to be a process of interviewing them on what they feel the quality of the actuarial advice is they've received.
I mean, appointed actuaries at the moment have, for a number of years had to review the effectiveness of the risk management framework. So I'm pretty sure there wouldn't be an appointed actuary who sort of sits in the office and does that without talking to anyone. And I'm pretty sure that most appointed actuaries would consider themselves a fairly key part of the risk management framework. So I mean, I appreciate the issue, but I don't see that it's anything new or anything that we haven't had to deal with in the past.
Anton, can I have a go at answering Martin's question too? So your question was, is the review of the framework a bit like a performance review of the actuary and his team or her team? And my answer is definitely not. If anything, it's more a performance review of the non-actuaries in the management team. Did they go and get actuarial advice before they went off on this project or that? It's definitely not a performance review of just the actuary and her team. So my answer to your question is no.
I think it's there's an element of that in that there are actuaries providing advice, and that is a one limb of the advice framework. So if that aspect has failed dismally, that should be part of the assessment of the effectiveness. But it's certainly only one part of a much broader assessment.
David Rush again. I'd agree with Stuart on that point. In fact, I think we've slightly wandered off topic here. Because I think the point that Warwick was raising is it appropriate to review the advice? And it's appropriate probably to review any advice that is provided by the actuary or anybody else. What the issue is here is whether or not it is appropriate to review the framework. And so I think we need to make the distinction between the framework and the advice.
Lastly, just wanted to cover off next steps from here. Obviously, we're in the middle of a member input phase, so thank you for your comments today. If there's anything else that comes to mind, please do send us comments. I think somewhere through the, if you can't find contact details for one of us, through to any of the practice committees can, the comments will find their ways down to us. The next key step for us will be APRA releasing the final prudential standard. As I said, we're expecting that before 30 June. We will then finalise a draft of the information note and send that out for comment, with the intent to issue the information note sort of as soon as possible after that to help people who, as I said, need to draft these things. So that was all of the content. I know we've had a number of questions along the way, but just sort of pause there and see if there's anything else that anyone would like to raise, or anyone on the webinar. Sounds like no. So thank you very much for coming.
Cheers, Rob. Thank you.